Hi, this is Fabrice Lapeltree for Creative Disturbance Project Pioneers and Pathbreakers channel. I'm a French art historian and my guest is the British curator, writer and researcher Bronek Ferran. We are today with the artist Lillian Lin.
So Lillian, this period in the 1960s, particularly before 1968, seems to have been, as you said, you know, a mecca in London. There was a massive amount of things going on in Paris. We look back on it now increasingly and we think, my goodness, how did the artists actually, you know, how did they come up with some of this stuff? It also was a period before, you know, man landed on the moon, etc. What was the mood of the atmosphere like in that time?
I think it was really very adventurous. You know, I think there, and you know, I'm talking from my perspective, but I think there were many areas of art that are not, you know, areas of kinetic art, perhaps not connected to science, that were just as adventurous. There was this extraordinary sort of spirit of energy. There was an extraordinary energy and a lot of contact between different areas as well. So there was a kind of looseness, kind of openness, and in a sense, really kind of friendliness, I think, between different areas. For example, I know that in Paris, I think it was 65 or 66, I showed at the Sonneberg Gallery. Now, the Sonneberg Gallery is not known for its interest in kinetic art or light art, but they did have this show of artists who were working with light. In Paris, I think 65 or 66, and I was in that show. I think I'm just citing that because I think it's, you know, a very open moment. And in those open moments, I mean, even physically, scientifically, you know, physically, that's when real creativity happens, you know, because there's cross-fertilization and there's a kind of chaos, a kind of, not real chaos, but the kind of mixing, you know, the categories are not as sharply defined. And I think that's when you have really exciting work being made because of that.
There's also a period where, you know, there was this sense that man might be leaving the Earth and landing on the Moon. You had satellites, and McLuhan talks about this as being able to actually look down on the Earth for the first time. Yeah. The sense of the electric universe, the starting to use electric light in works and things. How much was that kind of in the air, or was it just subliminally kind of influencing?
I gave an architect who was also amazing at that time, Buckminster Fuller. So Bucky, he was also thinking of the Earth as a planet, and his architecture was planetary, cosmic architecture. Yeah. And there was a woman who was a friend of mine called Caress Crosby, who has been completely forgotten. Quite extraordinary in my mind that somebody so great could be forgotten. She started something called World Man Center, and that was a center, a global center, non-national, against all nationalism. You know, she started something called Citizens of the World. She also started Women for Peace, and I mean, it was extraordinary. And the World Man Center was supposed to be in Cyprus, and they had President Makarios. This was started in 1963, I think, and I was supposed to go there actually. With Takis to meet up with Buckminster Fuller and Caress and Makarios to discuss this. And because artists were contributing works. I mean, artists, you know, like Picasso, Salvador Dali, you know, all these artists whose work was very valuable were contributing works to get the money to build this enormous dome that would cover the World Man Center. And then what happened was, it turned out that the politicians thought that Caress Crosby had a lot of money. They thought she was a millionaire. So they thought she was going to pour money into Cyprus. It turned out that she had no money. You know, this was all done with energy and idealism. And, of course, they blocked it because of that. When they found out that she didn't have a lot, she wasn't a millionaireess, you know, they kind of blocked the whole thing. It's extraordinary how narrow-minded politicians were.
Of course, this is also the time where people were starting to, well, were experimenting with, you know, LSD. There was various mind expansion.
And also music. Yeah. I mean, there was an extraordinary combination of music, film. You know, there was all the young filmmakers co-ops. There was a filmmaker cooperative here in London. And there was the Arts Lab, Jim Haynes, who started the Arts Lab, which was a very free, open place. There was Michael Cousteau at the ICA, who did the Polinaire show, who was... the thing about Michael that was interesting was that he brought together art and theater and literature. He brought those things together, those areas together.
So at the time, this is Fabrice speaking, at the time you seemed to say that you were breaking the borders between art, science, literature, theater, etc. So maybe you were looking maybe for a kind of fusion of everything. And I was
cross-fertilization, I would say. Yeah.
And I was thinking about, you know, this religious man, French man, his name is Teilhard de Chardin, who was talking about a kind of cosmic consciousness.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. So did a scientist, David Bohm.
Mm.
He also spoke about, and he was quite friendly with Krishnamurti. And there, although he never actually, you know, he would say that he wasn't a believer in anything, he did feel that there was a kind of, that you could think of a kind of cosmic consciousness. You know, that there was, that he felt that people, that human beings would never uncover a complete truth, if you like. I would say that there is no complete truth. It's quite simple, you know, that everything is constantly changing and moving and evolving, and so that you can, truth is static. That's the problem with political truths. That's is my problem with them, is that they once they formulate something, and it also works in art history, that once something is formulated, you can't change it. Whereas life is all about change. And so... if you believe in change, you cannot believe in any one formulaic truth.
And do you think that art and kinetic art especially are here to change the everyday life of people?
I think kinetic art contributes a great deal to the everyday life of people. And I think that's why, for example, the kinetic art show at the Hayward was the second... most popular exhibition in their history. At least it was at the time that I was told that. Yeah, and the first one was Van Gogh, and then the second was kinetic art. So you can understand why, because Van Gogh was a kind of fantasy hero that everybody knew about. You know, so much publicity, so much story, film. Whereas kinetic art, people didn't know about. It was a direct contact. And I remember that show was packed with people. Whereas if you go to the gallery normally, it's empty. You know, it's not packed with people. You know, that show packed in people.
Do you think it's still a phenomenon today, or has the idea of kinetic art been absorbed into a broader mainstream?
Oh, kinetic art is definitely not mainstream. Most art historians and dealers don't like kinetic art. I mean, and museums, curators are not interested. There are a few who are interested. There's, you know, Sabine, a few art in France, I think there's some interest in kinetic art. It's beginning, you know, and it starts, I mean, like, for example, there's an interest in light via somebody like Turrell. But Turrell, in my mind, is not a kinetic artist. Turrell is a painter. And all his work with light is painting, you know. As far as I'm concerned, you know, it's painting with light. You know.
So when I say absorbed, I mean, there are some people think that, like, op art in the 60s got too close to popular culture. It got absorbed into advertising. It got absorbed
into business. Oh, I see what you mean. Hmm.
Kinetic and op art were a little bit close. You know, this whole idea about playing with perception, using moving image, that's become our everyday.
Yeah.
It's not a seller. It's just become our everyday. You see it on our laptops, and you see it embedded in our gadgets. And
well, I think it's probably everything becomes absorbed one way or another, you know, into popular culture. But I don't really see. That's why movements are just movements. You know, they're just ways of labeling groups of artists' thinking. And they work historically, because historically, in a way, you have to look back and see how these things are coagulating.
Coagulating.
You know? You know? Yeah. And influencing people. Mm-hmm. But as far as artists are concerned, it's quite different, because I really think of art more as individuals. When I look back into history, and I was now in Berlin at the Gement Museum, and it's an amazing collection of art historically. And, you know, I didn't look at movements, I looked at individuals. You know, I looked at Durer, Rembrandt, you know, or Bosch. So I think the same thing will happen historically. I really don't, you know, I think it's the individuals in those movements, because the whole movement is not going to have the actual luminosity of a few people in it, because they're not that many really great artists.
So those few people within these, say, breakthrough moments of these periods, what do you think our responsibility is, as whether we're writers, researchers, you know, people who are interested in what is our responsibility in relationship to these collections and to these artists?
What your responsibility is?
Collectively.
Oh, collectively. I'm not sure how to answer that question.
Well, in terms of you, you're still making breakthrough work and pioneering work.
I can only make the work that's true to myself, right? So I have a certain kind of, I feel that I'm still researching, that I'm always experimenting, that I'm not sort of, you know, repeating the same thing, you know. But, you know, I mean, the thing is, you know, it's all to do, you know, artists are also human beings, and, you know, if there's a market for what they do, they'll produce it. So I think, in a way, the lucky artists are the ones that don't have markets. In some ways, you know, because in some ways, in that sense, kinetic art is quite interesting. There's a small market for it. It isn't huge.
So for you, it's ongoing research.
Yeah, I think it's ongoing research. It's constantly pushing the limits of what you're doing.
Excellent. Thank you. So Lillian, just picking up again on that fascinating thread about, you know, here we are now and I'm talking to you about work you made, which still seems visionary from the 60s. When you look back on the body of your work, do you think you've followed a consistent path, or have you been going in different directions at different times?
Well, basically, I suppose you could take the analogy of a tree. I mean, you know, we all know about the tree of life. Right? So if you take the analogy of a tree, my tree would be a very large spreading tree, you know, with a large spectrum, you know, wide spectrum. That's another analogy, of course, is different from the tree, and that is the spectrum. You know, every element has a particular spectrum. Well, my spectrum is large, but that doesn't mean it's good or bad, or better or worse. It's just large. And somebody like Bridget Riley, her spectrum is narrow. And you could say that because it's narrow, it's more intense, but I'm not sure that's true. I'm really not sure that's true. What I also think, it's very difficult to have this large spectrum. That's the thing I would be... I would say, I mean, because what happens is that there's always a kind of discontinuity. And I think that's something to do with one's background and one's life. I more and more feel that history is vital when you consider anybody, any artist or scientist, whatever, anybody that you're looking at or any phenomenon you look at, you have to look at the history, the development of it, and the influence of that history on the person. And so if I look at my own history was fragmented and discontinuous from the beginning, from birth. And so it's obvious that that's the way it's going to be, and that every you know, for example, going on a holiday would break the movement, the impetus of my work going away someplace. And then I would have to kind of reconnect. And that kind of chaotic fragmentation that I've experienced has been a great difficulty for me. But at the same time, it's also a strength. Because in every difficulty that you have, in every sort of contrary obstacle that you have, to go beyond that obstacle, to be able to face it and go beyond it, or work with it even, is in fact, I think, gives you an increased energy, an increased sort of density and in the actual work, in the product.
So now that different eras of your work is becoming recognized, how do you approach that in terms of, you know, what maybe you're wanting to focus on making new work, or do you concentrate on work you've made before? How do you play the past and the present and the future together?
Ah, well, that's a very interesting question, difficult question. Because, you see, I've come to think that there is no past, in a way, and that your life is just this... Fred Hoyle actually wrote a book about that, and use that analogy as using time as a map, kind of a physical map instead of a linear arrow. And I think more and more of my life as this kind of body, you know. And so to say that the work I did in 1963 or 4 or whatever is in the past, it isn't really in the past. If it interests me, I can wander back there. It won't be the same, though. Not because it's in the past, but because nothing is ever the same, you know. And I can't do the same drawing twice, you know. I can't write the same. Every time somebody asks me the same question about my work, I have to write a new essay because I look back at ones I've already written to answer that same question, and I think, oh, no, that doesn't work really. I have to say it again. I have to go into that again because my thoughts have changed. So I think change is the most important element, which takes us full circle, perhaps, to why kinetic art is of interest.
It's a kind of ever-changing map.
Yeah. In fact. Yes. I think it's an ever-changing map. It's a map that... The world is ever-changing, and we keep the same old maps.
Yes.
And, you know, sometimes you try to find something, and it's not, you know, you don't have a map for it, because they haven't changed the maps. In Italy, they never change the maps. They're very lazy. So you can't find the roads, because the map, they haven't changed the map, but the road has changed. I think that's sort of the same thing in the arts.